Teaching Me to Code Podcast, Episode 18, Interview with Dave Thomas, Part 2. Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the Teach Me to Code Podcast. This is your host, Charles Max Wood, and I have a few announcements before we get going. First off, you may have noticed that this is now the Teach Me to Code Podcast instead of the Rails Coach Podcast. That's by design. I've actually decided to combine my screencasting efforts and my podcasting efforts into one site. You're going to see some other changes coming on the Teach Me to Code website, such as I'm going to be starting up a newsletter, and we also got the Facebook page up for Teach Me to Code, and you can get there at facebook.com/teachmetocode. I don't really have any other major announcements, though I'm probably going to be involved in a few things coming up, including possibly the Agile Roots Conference in Salt Lake City. So anyway, without any further ado, I'm just going to go ahead and go into the interview, and I'll catch you on the other end. Thanks. Now, do you and Andy still do this kind of thing, or have you kind of gone off doing your different things?
No, we did for a long time. But the other unexpected thing is that we did all of the typesetting for the Pragmatic Programmer ourselves. So basically, we delivered to Addison Wesley camera-ready copy. It was a PostScript at the time. Complete with index and everything else.
Oh, wow.
So that was all, that was kind of fun. When the Ruby book came along, we did the same thing. We did all the typesetting and everything else for that as well. Mm-hmm. So we shipped these two books off to Addison Wesley. The Pragmatic Programmer did really well. The Ruby book kind of tanked. But that was cool. We went back to doing general consultancy. We're doing lots of interesting projects. And then around about 2001-2002-ish, the telecom thing burst and the consultancy market started to dry up a bit. So we had a little bit of time on our hands, and we came back to this observation that teams were really not doing the basics. And at the time, the basics that we felt were most desperately needed were testing, were version control, and automation. So we decided that we were going to write three short books, a couple hundred pages each, on each of those topics. So we started writing the version control and unit testing books. And the plan was to write them through Addison Wesley. So we started doing our normal business. We were doing all the typesetting and everything else. And at one point, we suddenly stopped and thought, why are we giving this book to Addison Wesley and getting our, you know, in absolute terms, royalty rates from them, when we're doing all the types of anything else, we could just do this book ourselves and then publish it ourselves. Mm-hmm. That was the most stupid idea that we ever had in our lives, because we frankly had no idea what was involved in actually publishing a book. If we had done that, we'd have just immediately dismissed the idea. Mm-hmm. But we didn't. So we formed a quick publishing business and went through, published these books for ourselves. We found a printer. And we were selling them direct. Once we had the tools set up to be able to do this, we then took the next step and had other people write for us. So we wrote the first two books in that starter kit series. Mike Clark, who is someone we knew from various speaking engagements, came and wrote the automation book, did a great job of that. So we then had an official author, which meant that we were doing things like paying royalties ourselves. Mm-hmm. And so from that point on, we kind of like fell into this idea that we were a publisher. We got distribution so that you could get the books, you know, pretty much anywhere in the world. We built our own online distribution system up, so we were fulfilling orders. And it kind of grew from there. We added more publishers, more authors to the mix, more titles. And we're up now over 100 titles. We sell direct books to, I don't know, 120 countries or something ridiculous last time I checked.
Oh, wow.
So for a little while in there, we were actually one of the fastest growing publishers in the world. But that's kind of easy when you start from nothing. Mm-hmm. But we are categorized as a medium-sized publisher by the publishing industry, which is kind of fun. The other nice thing is that because we didn't know what we were doing and we had no idea of the venerable history of the publishing industry, we didn't end up with all of the legacy stuff that an Addison Wesley, for example, has. They have done an incredible job of, you know, publishing books over, you know, I don't know how many years, 100, 200 years, whatever it might be. But during that time, obviously, you pick up, you know, ways of doing things. And we didn't have that. So we've been able to adapt very, very quickly as the publishing industry has evolved. Right now, publishers are, I mean, basically, you know, all of the windows in New York on the publishing buildings have been glued shut because otherwise people would be jumping out of them. The industry is in a serious decline. The common figure I hear is that something like every year book sales drop about 20% aggregate.
Oh, wow.
Which is, you know, scarily big drop. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing the same thing. If you look solely at the sales through conventional channels, so that would be sales through bookstores and sales through Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
But what we're seeing is that to counter that drop, we are selling incredible volumes on direct sales. In fact, I think we're unique as a publisher that our direct sales actually exceed our sales to the conventional channel. And most of those direct sales are various electronic formats. So I think we were the first publisher to have all of our titles available in electronic form. The first publisher to make them all DRM free. We were one of the first, and if not the first, to have all of our titles available in both PDF, Mobi, and EPUB formats. And one of the first publishers to say, if you buy electronic book from us, you get it in any format you want. You're not like buying the Mobi version, but you're buying right. all electronic forms. Because I believe very strongly that what you're doing is it's your book. Mm-hmm. You should have the right to use it, you know, as you see fit. So we've had a lot of fun doing that. We're continuing to do that. We've got books on iBooks in on the iPad, and we're looking at new ways of moving forward with content. And we're doing it the same kind of way. Remember earlier at the beginning of the conversation, we were talking about good developers are developers that, you know, listen to their customers and do things for their customers. And it's the same kind of thing here. I mean, we, like I say, really don't know anything about publishing, but we do know a fair amount about software development, and we know what developers need, or at least we think we do. We talk to developers a lot. We go to conferences, we go to user groups, and we chat with people and say, you know, what are the problems? And what's driving us right now is how can we today best address those needs? What can we do for developers now? And the answer is increasingly less give them, you know, massive big books. Certainly you don't give them reference books when, you know, the web has that kind of material available, mm-hmm. Probably more conveniently. But there is still a desperate need for well-constructed, well-edited material. The web is great at answering the small questions. It's really not great at answering the big questions. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, the area that, you know, you'll see every publisher, but certainly ourselves, helping in. That's our plan. So that was a long answer to your question of, do we still do consulting? The answer is, we were doing consulting. We had this business on the side, which was publishing. And the publishing business kind of took over. We were absolutely stunned by the fact that, you know, people were buying these books. And it got to the point where we were doing like 50% of the time publishing and then 70% of the time publishing. And now I would say, you know, 90% of my time is spent on the publishing side of the business. But I work very, very hard not to be just a publisher.
Mm-hmm.
Like right now, I'm sitting in front of my screens and I've got, you know, some TextMate buffers open because I'm working on some web stuff. I just got back from teaching a course on Rails last week. So I tried my best to stay technical in the midst of all this.
Yeah, I've been trying to figure out what I need to do to get you guys to come out to Salt Lake City and do a course.
That would be a question for Mike Clark. Fundamentally, you know, we will go where people want us to go. So if we can find a venue and, you know, sufficient butts to put on seats, then we would love to do Salt Lake.
All right. Well,
the home of the Agile Manifesto. So yeah, I'd like to get back there.
Yeah. In fact, I was going to ask you about that because I noticed I was looking into Agile and I saw the Agile manifesto, and you're one of the signatories on it, aren't you?
Yeah, I am. Andy and I are both signatories of it.
What prompted, or how did you get involved? Did somebody just call you up and say, hey, you're important, come? Or
not quite. Let's think. When we finished Pragmatic Programmer, that was, it went out in 99, I guess. End of 98, 99. We started getting invitations to conferences. I mean, we'd always been going to conferences on and off, but now we're getting invited to speak. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of weird. You're the same person you were before you published a book, but, you know, because you've got the book, you know, they'll give you a slot to give a talk or whatever else. And that means you get to talk to other speakers because you'll meet them in a little speaker's lounge or whatever else. Mm-hmm. And so we got chatting with a variety of people at conferences like Uppsala. And at the time, Uppsala had people like Martin Fowler, Kent Beck, Ron Jeffries, Ward Cunningham, who were all working on their own things, on patterns, on methodologies with a small m. Kent Beck was beginning to write about XP at the time. So there were always conversations going on about how we wrote software. Everybody was fascinated with how can we better write software. And out of those conversations came a couple of get-togethers where we just basically went to some retreat somewhere and just talked about, you know, how software could work. And one of those retreats was in Snowbird, which is a resort just up the road from Salt Lake City. Mm-hmm. And we went there to talk about how we could present to people the ideas that we had about writing software. And it was really organized in a very ad hoc way. The first part of the discussion is where should it be? And at the time, it was going to be in the Caribbean in February. And then we all stopped and thought, how are we going to tell our wives that we're going away to talk about software development? Oh, by the way, we're going to the Caribbean. So instead, we went to Snowbird, which is a safer thing, given that only one or two of us could actually ski. And we just basically turned up with no agenda whatsoever. And on the first morning, we got rid of the tables in the room. We sat the chairs in a circle. And I think it was Martin Fowler handed out a whole bunch of index cards and basically said, write down, you know, what you want to achieve from this meeting on index cards and throw them into a pile in the middle of the room. So we all had fun being 4 years old, throwing these index cards into piles. And we collected them all up and divided them out, and we found some common themes. And from those common themes arose the manifesto for agile software development. And all it really was an expression of what we already were doing. Mm-hmm. I like to say that we didn't invent agile software development. We just gave it a name. Agile software development, if you were a good developer and if you have the freedom to develop the way that you think you should develop, then the chances are pretty good you're doing something agile. You're doing it in an agile way. Mm-hmm. So all we really did was kind of crystallize that a bit. So we took our little manifesto and the kind of notes that backed it up, and we stuck it up on a website, and we invited people to agree to it by basically signing their name. And to our amazement, we got thousands and thousands of signatories. Mm-hmm. And a whole little sub-industry that's kind of spawned off it, which was actually kind of one of the interesting things, because the people in that room, I mean, some of them are consultants that make money from helping people with methodology issues. Mm-hmm. But by and large, we really were not interested in agility as a marketing tool or as, you know, a product. Mm-hmm. And I think all of us have been a little bit dismayed by the way that it's been usurped as a brand, you know, because really it's not a brand. It's just a personal or team set of ideals. And it's no more a brand than, you know, free speech is a brand. But it seems to have, you know, been twisted a little bit that way.
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, I got my degree in computer engineering, so I did some programming, and you would hear every once in a while the word agile or agile development kind of float through as you're talking to people. And, you know, and then as I went through technical support and QA and then finally into software development, you know, you'd hear people talk about agile and everybody's talking about something different, you know. Yeah. And it was really interesting to me, you know, just this last year to discover this Agile Manifesto and to realize that a lot of the baggage that comes with the terminology isn't necessarily the root or core of what Agile development is.
That's absolutely true. It's absolutely true. And yeah, there's a whole bunch of kind of carnival sideshows that have sprung up around the idea of Agile. But yeah. Fundamentally, it's those four principles, mm-hmm. The idea of focusing on the customer side, not on the project side, on delivering value. Those are the, you know, that's the essence of it. And if you just ask yourself, am I, you know, adopting these principles when I make decisions? If the answer is yes, then you are, you know, doing agile stuff.
That makes sense. I do have a couple more questions for you. One thing that I think is really interesting, if you, I've been looking through your blog and reading your blog, is that I find references to music. It looks like you're a composer of at least some skill. I don't know enough about music to tell you whether you're terrific or not, but
neither do I, but I know I'm not, so you don't have to be good to recognize someone who's drowning, you know, so
I guess my question is do you see any parallels between your expression of yourself or your ideas in music and your expression of yourself or ideas in your code?
That's a really good question, and I don't have a full answer for it, but I do have some observations. First of all, if you look at the general population, I don't know what percentage play an instrument to a proficient level. I would guess 2, 3, 4, 5, something like that percent. Mm-hmm. If you go into the speaker lounge of a conference and say, who can play an instrument or who takes part in creating music, I'd be amazed if you got less than 30 or 40%. Mm-hmm. Right? So I'm thinking that it's maybe 10 times more in this particular community. That's significant. I would say that most of the people that I respect in software, no, that's not true. A large number of the people I respect in software have some kind of musical background. Chad Fowler, for example, is fundamentally a musician. He was trained and he went to school on composition, doing jazz. He used to play in Memphis. He's a great all-around musician. And he writes great software too. Mm-hmm. But that's, in a way, he came to that late. He came to that through, actually through video games. So I think there's a big correlation there. What I don't know is why there's a correlation. And I know that there are other people who are kind of like researching that. I mean, some of my ideas from my own experiences doing composition is that one of the features of composition is the idea of structure and the ideas of tension and resolution. So what you're doing is you're trying to construct a piece that has some internal cohesion, but which isn't boring, which mm-hmm. has, you know, interesting stuff going on, and ideally has parallel lines going through it that meet in a logical, non-contrived way. I'm not good at it, but one of the joys of good composition is every now and then things just come together and you go, wow, I wasn't expecting that. How did he pull that off? It's brilliant. Mm-hmm. You know, the same things apply to writing software, I think, in that what you're doing when you're writing software is you're constructing patterns, not as in design patterns. You're constructing structures mm-hmm. that work together well. And you're doing it at multiple levels. So you're writing, you know, individual lines of code or small little methods that do something, but then you're also writing larger scale structures. Mm-hmm. And they're somehow they all come together to do something, you know? And in good software development, in code that is exceptional, you'll get that kind of, wow, I wasn't expecting that moment, where things come together in a way that is just really, really smart and looks effortless. But in reality, it took a whole bunch of thinking to get all the ducks lined up, you know? And I think maybe the skill for that is similar to the skill that musicians use, particularly jazz musicians, who are sitting there, you know, I mean, if you're looking for agile people, jazz musicians are it. You know, they go in there with, you know, a single sheet of paper that maybe has some chord progressions on it, and from that they construct half an hour's worth of music. And they do it by listening to each other, by adapting what they're doing, by following certain unwritten rules, and by having a whole bunch of talent. And I think, you know, a good team operating is very similar to a good jazz group operating.
That makes a lot of sense. I don't have anything to ask or add on top of that. I mean, it really just does. It makes a lot of sense. I'm also wondering, I've been reading The Pragmatic Programmer, and in toward the beginning you mentioned a couple of practices that you recommend that people do, and one of them was actually to learn a new language every year. So I'm kind of curious about two things. One is how many languages have you tried out over the course?
I wouldn't know how to count them. I don't know. It's really hard to say. I mean, I'm probably capable of writing, you know, now just without reference, 20 or 30. But I've tried way, way more. I love programming languages. And so if I come across a reference to someone saying, hey, I slapped this out in whatever the language might be, I will try and find a copy of it and mess around with it. The same way I used to when I was, you know, before you wrote programming Ruby. It's just a kind of, it's a hobby. It's an interest of mine. So I love looking at programming languages. And after a while, you get to be able to, I guess, you know, you hear about people who are linguists who, you know, say, you know, once you've learned six, then the seventh is really easy kind of thing. And I think it's, in a way, the same with programming languages, in that there are only so many ways that people have yet discovered to do things. So there are variants, and there are people who can do very clever things, but ultimately there are different categories or classes of language, and when you know the paradigm, you can kind of fairly quickly pick them up. So what that means is that learning a new language is really a question of learning in which ways is it different from the languages on which it's based.
Right.
One of the cool things to me about Ruby is that it kind of breaks that mold, because Ruby is one of those kind of, it's a multi-paradigm language. It's a regular procedural language. It's an object-oriented language. You can write prototype-based development code in it. Some people claim it's functional, but really it's not. I mean, Ruby is functional in the same way that a Trabant is a car. But I mean, it can do some functional things. But underpinning it all is this very, very elegant meta-object protocol. And what that means is that it has total consistency all the way down. There are almost no special cases in the underlying execution model of Ruby. But then on top of that, Yukihiro Matsumoto, who invented or designed or whatever Ruby, added the most ambiguous parser I think I've ever come across. It is a wild ride trying to parse Ruby code. And so from my point of view, that means that I have this rock-solid foundation in the internal execution model, and I have this really funky, interesting language on top of it. And so I can write rock-solid code, but at the same time, I can discover new things that I never knew about the language. I mean, I've been doing Ruby probably as long as anybody else in the States. And I am still learning new things about the language, and I love that about it. It keeps it fresh. So one of the things is about learning language is you got to stop yourself from becoming stale, no matter what you're doing, right? If you're sitting there and your day job is coding Java or C# or whatever it might be, you know, the kiss of death is when people say to you, what do you do? And you say, I'm a Java programmer. Right? I mean, that's kind of like so sad, because the reality is, yeah, that's like saying, you know, you go into a builder and say, you know, what do you do? And they say, I'm a hammer operative, you know?
Right.
No, I mean, you know, what you do is you build houses, and a hammer is one of the tools. So is a saw, so is a level, so is a pencil, right? Mm-hmm. The same applies. If you go around thinking of yourself as a Java developer, then you've only got one tool, and that's just not going to work. Mm-hmm. So you need to keep yourself fresh. You need to investigate new languages, and better, you need to investigate different ways of thinking about languages. Mm-hmm. So when I first started playing with functional programming languages, it dramatically changed the way I write my Ruby code, mm-hmm. because I learned new ways of thinking about stuff, and it applies outside just pure functional languages. When I started doing JavaScript and Self and got into the idea of prototype-based languages, that changed the way I write Ruby code.
Mm-hmm.
The whole thing is kind of like, you know, you pick out the ideas, you pick out the things that work, and you look to use them. Mm-hmm. And that's why learning a new language is really important, because, you know, that exposure to a different culture, a different way of thinking, will only enrich the way you do whatever you do day on day.
Right. And if you're listening and you're wondering what Dave's talking about with the execution or object model for Ruby, he's actually done several screencasts, and you can find those at pragmaticprogrammer.com. They are excellent.
Oh, thank you for pimping me like that. I appreciate that.
Well, I've watched them, and they totally expanded the way I understood what I was doing with just my Ruby code and what I was doing with Ruby on Rails. So, you know, I have no problem telling people that what I've seen and, you know, what I've used has helped or not helped. I do have one more question for you, and then I'm going to let you go because I've already taken up almost an hour of your time. Fundamentally, it looks like you've kind of evolved into an entrepreneur. You know, I've looked at your blog. It looks like you own a karate studio, or at least partially own a karate studio. You have the Pragmatic Programmers, and, you know, you've even done consultancy, which is entrepreneurial. I talk to a lot of developers that talk about, well, you know, I'd like to get out on my own and do this or that. You know, they have some idea of some application they could build or some service they could provide. And I'm just wondering what recommendations or what things should people know going into trying to be an entrepreneur in the programming or service provider space?
Well, I guess the first thing is don't do it, or at least don't do it that way. I think I've been working for myself now since I guess for the last 25 years. And the way I got into it is the way I would recommend everybody get into it, and that is, I was employed. I had a full-time job, and in the evenings and weekends, my first partner and I in England created a particular product. It was actually a terminal emulator that ran on PCs for a particular kind of financial terminal. And we produced this terminal emulator, and we sold it into the City of London onto the trading desks there. And, I mean, we didn't make like a boatload of money, but we made enough that we were we had comfortable cash flow for about 4 months. And based on that, we then basically quit our full-time jobs and started doing software development and consultancy. So part of the trick of branching out is not to just jump, but to do it in such a way that you are not always worried about the next paycheck, about the next bill. Give yourself some cushion and maintain that cushion. One of my rules of life in independent business is that I always have to have 3 to 4 months worth of cash flow sitting in my checking account, because without that, I'm going to make bad decisions. I'm always going to compromise because I need the money and I don't want to be in that position.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I would say that's vitally important is do what interests you. Don't do something because you think, hey, I can make a lot of money at this, because the reality is, yeah, one person makes some money and 10,000 don't. And, you know, they're not great odds. So if you're going to spend, you know, 14 hours a day working on something, it had better be something that you really want to work on, or something that you really enjoy doing.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, my second rule of entrepreneurship is find your passion and work on that. And people are attracted by passion. And typically, the passionate people are the ones that will succeed.
Mm-hmm.
And really, just listen to people, because you're not always going to get it right. In fact, you're probably likely never to get it right 100%. So spend a lot of your time listening to the people that you're doing this for. And just, you know, constantly try and make things a little bit better. Don't compromise your ideas, but at the same time, understand that you can be wrong. And just keep developing. So I guess I'm looking at, you know, this is not the big splash, go out, get, you know, 10 million in venture capital and retire. This is the incremental slow path, but I think it's also the one that's, you know, the most satisfying and probably the most sustainable. That's what I've done throughout my career, and it seems to have worked okay.
Sounds great. Now, is there anything else that you want to add before we wrap this up?
Not really. I mean, it's just, I think the fundamental idea is that what we're doing in software development is ridiculously hard. We have a technically incredibly challenging environment. I frankly, if I look at the amount of stuff that you have to know nowadays to do software development, I just don't even know how people could enter the industry. It's just so much to know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very, very challenging technical role. Then on top of that, you've got this very, very demanding world that you're trying to interact with. So it's a very, very stressful job. It's a very hard job. I know that, you know, after a long day of programming, I am physically tired. And most people I know are the same. It's mm-hmm. really, really tiring. So do not get into this, and don't continue to do it unless it's fun, unless you're enjoying it. Because it's, you know, there's absolutely no point in being on this kind of death march if you're not having fun. So, you know, I always try and sign the Ruby book, above all, make it fun. Because I think that's the most, you know, underlying tenet for everything we do. If you're not enjoying yourself, then you really, you know, you owe it to yourself to find something else that you would enjoy more.
Sounds a lot like what Yukihiro Matsumoto says about Ruby, that, you know, the fundamental purpose for man is that they have joy, and that's why he wrote Ruby, is so that people could enjoy what they do.
And he did a fine job of it.
Yeah, he sure did. Well, thank you so much, Dave. If people want to find out what's going on, they can look at your blog. It looks like it hasn't been updated in a while, like you said, but you know, I also recommend that people go check out your code katas, which we didn't really have time to talk about, but also are great exercises. And follow you on Twitter as @PragDave. And, you know, go check out some of these books. They're just excellent, excellent. Not just references, but really kind of user's manuals that can walk you through learning how to program in Ruby or Rails, or even guide you in what you need to be thinking about as a programmer in the Pragmatic Programmer.
That's very kind of you to say. So I've been really enjoyed the talk, Chuck.
Yeah, I've enjoyed it too. Thank you.
Okay. Take care. Bye-bye.
Yeah, bye. All right. Well, that will wrap it up. I just want to thank Dave again for coming onto the podcast. There were just some excellent, excellent pieces of advice that he gave us as far as becoming better programmers and making contributions to our own careers and to the community at large. I really think that a lot of the things that he told us were things that I think we all should think about how we can do better. I don't know really what else to add. I do have a few other announcements. One is that I'm going to be working on some screencasts that I'm going to be actually putting up available for purchase. The approach I'm taking with Teach Me to Code is I'm going to be putting out the shorter, less than 10-minute screencasts every 2 weeks, and on the other, every other week, I'm going to put out a 20 to 30 minute, or 15 to 30 minute, I guess, screencast there. And these other screencasts will be an hour or maybe a little longer in length. And the reason that I'm going to be charging for those is just that the production time on a video that long sometimes takes a while. And so in order to justify the time, I need to ask a little. And so I'm hoping to find some topics that are interesting or worthwhile to you. So if you have any suggestions for me, feel free to email me, chuck@teachmetocode.com. And that's all I have. Thanks.